Hello and welcome back to another episode of Humanities Matter by Brill. I'm your host, Ramzi Nasser. I'm, among other things, an independent researcher based in Madrid, Spain, with a background in economics and West Asian studies. I'm really excited about today's episode. It's a really special one. I think you will enjoy it. There are really few things that can stir human emotions like music. And there are very few things that can tell the story of cultures like music. What are the sciences and arts of listening? How does music interact with other art forms? How has music evolved over centuries in different parts of the world? And what can we learn about the universal human experience through music? Today's episode dedicated to the musics of the world. You know, a big part of our cinematic or gaming experience today is those grand overtures playing in the background. And a lot of the time that music is rather apocalyptic, reflecting the existential crises of players and characters. Now, it makes sense with the looming threats of climate change, nuclear winters, that there is just something about that Desire or Wagnerian apocalyptic soundtrack that we just can't get enough of. But it would appear that we've been taken with apocalyptic music since medieval times. Why is that? We're going to speak with Dr. Colin McAllister to find out. Dr. McAllister is a musician and co-editor of the book Music in the Apocalyptic Mode, published by Brill. And it brings together scholars and composers from various disciplines and around the world to explore this very question. Dr. McAllister, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Ramzi. Thanks for having me on.
When one thinks about apocalyptic music, one immediately thinks of Desire or Wagner's Ring Cycle. But your volume really shows how it's also prominent in African-American spirituals, in blues, in the music of Bob Dylan, and even in contemporary Christian rock music. How would you describe what ties all these things together? In other words, what characterizes music in the apocalyptic mode?
Yeah, great question. Well, at the outset of this project, this co-edited volume between Lorenzo Di Tommaso and myself, we felt it important to try and kind of delimit what music in the apocalyptic mode could actually be. And this kind of mirrors an effort almost 50 years ago by scholars, including John J. Collins and others, who worked to define what really is the literary genre of apocalypticism. And this includes aspects like a narrative framework, some kind of divine revelation through an intermediary figure, imagery of heaven and hell, and certainly a preoccupation with what happens at the end times. So the apocalyptic worldview is a particular way of looking at space, time, and human existence. Apocalyptic speculation is largely a response to scenarios, societal, cultural, political, environmental, and so that seem untenable and insurmountable beyond human cognition and agency. In other words, the order of the world is not how it's supposed to be. And that this might require some kind of superhuman intervention into the fabric of history to set matters aright. And then a mode, on the other hand, of course, in music, is a type of scale, a succession of pitches. And in apocalyptic speculation, we might say that a mode is one of two basic stances in which this apocalyptic worldview is expressed. On the one hand, what we might call traditional or biblical apocalypticism that directly comes out of reflections upon texts like the Hebrew Bible's Book of Daniel or the Book of Revelation, the last book in the New Testament canon. And on the other hand, a secular stance on what apocalypticism is. So we took these two into consideration and we looked at four different ways in which we thought meaning might be expressed in music or imparted through music. And First and most obvious probably is lyrical content, which you alluded to a little bit. Of course, the Dies Irae, which is a 13th century hymn about Judgment Day, the libretti of the operas of Wagner, but also the poetry of Stefan Georg as set by Arnold Schoenberg, or the longing for freedom and salvation found in African-American spirituals and blues, or social justice aspects in the lyrics of Bob Dylan and Bob Marley, for example. Secondly, we might consider musical elements, that is, harmony, rhythm, timbre, texture, form, etc. And some examples of this might be musical battle scenes found in cantatas of Johann Sebastian Bach, or the prolongation of harmonic resolution in Wagner, or intimations of eternity in the temporal schemes of French composer Olivier Messiaen, or the use of revelations, numerology, and catastrophic imagery as a formal device in contemporary art music. Third, we might consider visual imagery, and perhaps the best known example of this would be in contemporary music videos. We have a couple chapters in our volume that discuss the song Land of Confusion by Genesis and its 2005 remake by the band Disturbed. Or another one on the series of videos created for Grimes' most recent album called Misanthropocene. And then fourth, a fourth way in which meaning might be imparted in music is through its performative aspect. And this could range from staging of the medieval play of Antichrist to the costumes and stage appearance of death metal bands to DJs performing at raves in abandoned industrial buildings. So I think to kind of come back to your question, I think that that's how we have characterized music in the apocalyptic mode, trying to define what it is, and then looking at these ways in which meaning can be imparted in music. Lyrics are obviously the one that folks turn to first, but we wanted to branch out into these other different areas as well.
Fantastic. What do you think it is about the Christian Bible's Book of Revelation to John, or the book that you mentioned in the Hebrew Bible? Although I think that in general in pop culture, the Book of Revelation seems to have been more of a touch point. What do you think the Book of Revelation, what is it about it that has made it such a constant source of musical inspiration over so many centuries, different geographies, and all the different musical styles that you've alluded to? And when thinking about that, I also wonder, is there something particularly Occidental or Western about music in the apocalyptic mode?
Yeah, indeed. Apocalypticism in general is Western in its genesis. The two primary religions which have inspired apocalyptic thinking, Judaism and Christianity, are teleological. They have a definitive beginning and they look towards a definitive end, the end times, finite ending to the universe. And this way of thinking first manifested as a literary genre in the period of Second Temple Judaism. And the bulk of what we might call classical apocalypses, which include Book of Daniel and the Revelation of John, but also lesser known texts like First Enoch and Fourth Ezra and Second Baruch. These texts were composed between roughly 200 BCE and 200 CE. And the genre has key aspects that I alluded to before, including supernatural revelation, tours or visitations to the heavenly or infernal realms, angels and demons, eschatological judgment, and recurring expectation of the imminent end of history. And the Revelation of John just happens to be the best known of these texts. Of course, it's in the biblical canon, and it's a very very well-written example of these texts. It's very attractive for interpreters. In fact, more commentaries have been written on the Book of Revelation than any other biblical book. And it's compelling from both a visual and an auditory perspective. One might think about images like the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, or the number of the beast 666, or the voice calling out like the sound of many waters, or the golden new Jerusalem. And all of these visual and auditory images lend themselves to artistic rendering in many media, including music.
You also have a chapter in the book specifically focused on Arnold Schoenberg. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And you describe him as an apocalyptic prophet. What was it about Schoenberg that was so prophetic?
Yes, and you got the name right on the nose there. Arnold Schoenberg, a composer who is perhaps best known for writing music without a tonal center, and then introducing the 12-tone system of composition, or the dodecaphonic system of composition, which is a method of organizing pitch material in the absence of functional tonality. And for those who are listening who aren't musicians, I'll just say that tonal music is almost all of the music that we listen to. In other words, it's music that has a certain chord as a home base and a certain series of chords that move through the piece of music, always coming back to the home base. And then scales, single pitches that are used for the melody. So most music that we listen to is tonal music. But as the 19th century progressed, this tonal foundation, which had been in place in common practice since about the year 1600 or so, gradually began to weaken. And many composers were pushing the structures of tonal music to the brink, especially Wagner, who we mentioned earlier. And so Schoenberg very much felt a compulsion as an artist to continue progressing towards that which is new. He felt that if you're if you are a responsible artist, if you are an ethical artist, you are really obliged to not just continue in the tradition of things that have come before you, but to push that envelope. And so starting in about 1899, Schoenberg was born in 1874, so he's in his mid-20s at this point. He moves gradually through a series of pieces towards basically doing away with this need for tonality in his music. And he finally crosses this Rubicon in his second string quartet, which was completed in 1908. And in the third and fourth movements of the quartet, Schoenberg adds a soprano voice, and he sets texts by a poet, Stefan Georg, and specifically from Georg's collection called The Seventh Ring, which is a sort of reworking of the Book of Revelation. It's heralding the end of an old era and declaring the dawning of a new one. And so this Schoenberg's move here, a significant move between really crossing this boundary between tonal and non-tonal music, is kind of, I argue, an apocalyptic and transfigurative event that forever changed the way harmony functioned by obliterating and then redefining the dualism and the teleology inherent in common practice tonality. So common practice tonality, like apocalypticism, is looking towards the finish line, the resolution of chordal movement. That's why people clap at the end of a Mozart symphony or a Beethoven symphony, because it's very clear when the end is happening. There's a big tonic chord, usually very loud and very definitive. And so Schoenberg did away with this. And to me, that's a very important moment in musical history. Schoenberg also had a term that he called the emancipation of the dissonance, which he meant that all sonorities in music could function as equals, no longer being ruled over in a way by this idea that dissonance all must be resolved in service of getting to this tonic. This way of looking at this emancipation of the dissonance, I think, is kind of an analog to the liberating social function of classic apocalyptic literature. You look at the revelation of John, and it's There are these letters at the beginning that are exhorting the faithful to say, hey, stay the path. We know this is challenging. You're going through difficult things, but eventually God is going to take care of the way the world functions and rid the world of evil and in a way reward you, save you for your good conduct. And so at the time of the composition, back to your question about this prophetic Schoenberg, at the time of the composition of this quartet, Schoenberg, I think, may very well have regarded himself and his art in a prophetic or revelatory role due to a few different factors. First, he was experiencing a sense of alienation and crisis in his personal and professional life. He believed that art was a spiritual moral practice that pointed towards the future. And furthermore, that a genius was required to see into this future. He certainly identified at this time with the poetry and the persona of this poet, Stefan Georg, who, by all accounts, was very charismatic and had kind of a circle of disciples around him. Schoenberg had the same, particularly with two younger composers named Alban Berg and Anton Webern, who went on to become very famous composers in their own right. But at this time, they really treated Schoenberg like some kind of prophet, like he was this almost divine light illuminating the future. And fourth, Schoenberg, throughout his life, a central element in his writings about music concern what he called the musical idea, the musikalische Gedanke, that which forms this essential kernel and most important aspect of a musical work, yet evades precise definition. And Schoenberg believed that this idea is perceived intuitively, that is, not by rational means, that somehow some kind of extra rational ability is required to see this. So I guess to sum it up, yeah, I do feel that Schoenberg felt his art in a prophetic way at that time. And I was certainly looking at these series of pieces, particularly the second string quartet. And I think Ramzi, you got to put sexy titles on things. And so Schoenberg is Apocalyptic Prophet, I think, was something that settled on me as something that maybe would grab people's attention.
It certainly grabbed my attention. It's a great title. And I after that, now I'm going to now go listen to Schoenberg and that string quartet. That sounds fantastic.
Oh, I hope you do. It's really, I mean, even before I started thinking about apocalyptic music long time ago, I found this music to be so compelling because in it, without even reading anything about it, I could just really sense that Schoenberg is grasping for something, that he's really trying to get to something that maybe he doesn't even know where it's going. So it's very powerful music, and I hope all of our listeners will get a chance to take a look and a listen.
Definitely. So to sum it all up, why do you think the apocalypse resonates with us as much as it does?
Well, yeah, this is one of the things I like. That's a great question. And one of the things I like about studying apocalypticism in all its forms is that on the one hand, it can be a very specialized discipline. You're learning these ancient languages, Latin and Greek and Syriac and Old Armenian and so forth, to translate all of these texts. But on the other hand, of course, it's something that resonates with everyone, as you say. Apocalyptic thinking addresses universal human concerns, things like the search for identity and belonging, speculation about the future. And of course, for some people, it's a blueprint that provides meaning and structure to a seemingly chaotic world. It's a perennially timely topic. Apocalypticism is integrally related to ideas of inclusion and exclusion, dualism, social justice, migration, and the formation of the idea of an other who is different from ourselves. We live in a world, of course, of perpetual transition, of rapid change, which to many people can feel unsettling and difficult. And I think that every generation sees itself as a privileged one, Perpetual change is often felt by many as perpetual crisis. And so that's why there's oftentimes this turn by humans toward some kind of superhuman entity who can, in a way, save us from ourselves. And of course, for faith-based people, that might be God or Christ or some sort of spiritual guru. And for others, it might be the right political candidate or the right life coach who can be this almost messiah-like figure to lead us out of the darkness. You probably read, I always talk about my favorite band is Blue Oyster Cult. And they had this song on the same album, by the way, that has the song Don't Fear the Reaper, which many people know. It's probably their best known song. But they had another song that opens the record called Summer of Love. And there's a lyric that says, things ain't what they're supposed to be, and this ain't the summer of love. And I think that that's sometimes how humanity views the current situation. And apocalypticism is a way to address those fears and those concerns and those uncertainties.
Indeed, that's beautiful. That was great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure. And please check out the new book, anyone who's interested.
From apocalyptic music in the West, we move eastward to court music in the Near and Middle East. We speak with Dr. George Dimitri Sawa, a musician and author of The Ear's Pleasure and the Science of Listening to Music by Ahmed B. Yusuf Al-Tifashi Al-Kafsi, to be published by Brill this December. Dr. Sawa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's a great pleasure to have you on the show. I want to start by asking you, what is so special about, you've written a whole book about another book from the 13th century. It must be a really special book. What is so special about this book from the 13th century? What does it describe, and what can we learn from it today about how music may have been perceived at the time, music's relationship to poetry, to literature, to dance, and maybe also the influence of music from one region onto other different regions at that time?
Okay, we have a lot of material about music in Syria and Iraq, and not much about music in North Africa and Andalusia. So this treatise by Al-Tifashi is a real treasure. It tells us about the instruments used in Andalusia and North Africa, Maghreb, Libya, Egypt, and what musical modes they used, maqamat, and then the idea of meter, what meters they used, what musical forms, and the primordial use of poetry, because our culture is a vocal culture, whether it is Egypt or Syria or Iraq or Andalusia or the Maghreb, we are obsessed with singing. And that puts instrumental music on the second level. And often, if you are not a singer, you're not exactly second-class musician, but you're not as important as the singer. Because the singer, as Farabi said, has all the voice has all the properties of the instruments, plus it had words that have meaning and denote passion and emotion. And as you know, Arabs are crazy about poetry. So when it is sung, it's even better.
Yes, that's fantastically clear. I'm curious, this particular text is situated in one place, but it seemed to have possibly discussion of music in various different regions and how they're interrelated.
Correct, because he was born in... Yeah, go ahead.
No, just could you share a bit about that with our listeners?
Yeah. He was born in Tunis, but studied in Cairo. So he knows the scene in Tunis. He knows the scene in Cairo, in the Maghreb. And he has a lot of material written about music in medieval Islamic Spain. And he has a lot of material, again, about musical forms, about some vocal techniques which were based on the writing of Farabi and Isfahani and Ibn Tahan, but he adds more to it. For example, from Ibn Tahan, who is 11th century Cairo, Ibn Tahan talks about the tarjiyah. Tarjiyah means I'm going to sing a section of the poem or a section of the line of poetry, and I'm going to repeat it, rajah, with the intent of revising it, developing it, and making it better, tarjiyah. So if you listen to Umm Kulthum's song in her older days, she would do precisely that, and she repeats over and over, and the audience goes wild because you ornament it and you better it. This is the beauty of tarjiyah. So we hear, for example, that a singer sung one line of poetry for 2 hours. One line over and over for 2 hours. And the only way we can do that with the tarjiyah, you develop the theme, you ornament it, and sing it again. And you hear yourself said, well, I did okay, I can do better. And then the singer goes ahead and does better. The same thing with the Muqra in Cairo. The sheikh who recite the Holy Quran, they often say that. They have a little a section of a surah, they repeat it over and over and make it better. And also in the Sabah Fakhri, when you sing Mushahat, or the chanter, when they sing, also they chant Mushahat, they do the same thing. And then they talk about the ornament, the hezza, the vibrato. One line of poetry uses 74 hezza. It's phenomenal. Phenomenal how gifted these singers were. It's unbelievable. So in short, we have an amazing tradition. We have an amazing history of music and poetry and performance and composition.
Oh, yeah, I think I understand. What you're indicating is that there really is a straight line from this 13th century book describing music in the past to contemporary musical traditions in the region. It shows that there's a long history to that music. The book also touches on, Tafashi's book also touches on the relationship between music and other arts, literature and dance. Can you share a little bit about that with our listeners as well?
Yes, he talks about music and poetry. And often people have sort of a vague idea, oh, there is a relation, but they don't know what the relation is. If we try to explain music theory by using poetry, we will fail because in poetry you have short and long syllables. In music, you have short and long and very long and very, very, very long, etc. So you cannot use the Arud theory, that is the structure of poetry, to explain music. On the other hand, if you stick to the rhythm of the verse of the poetry and make the music sound much like the rhythm of the poetry, then the result will be very poor. And often music destroys the rhythm of poetry, and that is on purpose. Because if I follow the poetry word for word, there'll be no the rhythm will be very poor. So you have this melisma, many notes to a syllable, so you make the poetry longer. You improvise. So in short, there is a relation and there is no relation. There is a relation because the composer used the poetry to get inspired to compose music. But there is no relation because music rhythm is much more sophisticated than the rhythm of the poetry. Then you have the subject of dance. And this is where Tafashi went beyond the previous writers. And he used his writing on the writing of Ibn Tahan and Ibn Khordazba. However, there are sections in the Ibn Tahan treatise that are empty, they're lost. And we can reconstitute them from Al-Tifashi 2 centuries later, which is fantastic. The same thing with Ibn Khordazba. There are some material that survived, other material that did not. And again, you can reconstitute it from Al-Tifashi. And he added sort of way more than that. Not only he said, Ibn Tahan said this and that about the dance, Ibn Khordazba said this and that about the dance, but I am going to add this and that about the dance. So he's telling us dance in Andalusia, and Western scholars of medieval Spanish music and European music are going to go wild when they read the material. On top of the details of what makes a good dancer, like to have a good sense of rhythm, you have to wear the proper attire, you have to follow the music. At the same time, he tells us about shadow plays, al-khayal, which probably came from China, where you dance, where you have puppets dancing behind a curtain, and there is a candle light to make these puppets move. And Al-Tifashi tells us there are 4 different types of shadow dance, and he explained them. And it adds so much to our knowledge of dance and shadow plays and shadow dance.
So it sounds like the book that Tifashi wrote is exceptional, not just for its encyclopedic breadth, but also for the analysis and contributions that he made on top of that.
Exactly, exactly. And he sort of saved for us some material that's lost. I mean, there are blank pages in the treatise of Ibn Tahan when it comes to dance, and it's all supplied by Tifashi. Plus the music instruments that were in use. So not only they have the oud, the lute, and the nai, and the drum and the tambourine, but they also have sheaths, which is wood blocks, and castanet, like the Spanish castanet, safaqa. And they have cymbals. And apparently their best instrument was the oboe, what we call mizmar in Egypt and Syria, because it's a very powerful instrument and used for weddings. Yeah, the castanet and also the safaqa. It's 2 long pieces of wood that clap. You clap with them. And they're not the castanet, they're not the cymbal, they're clappers. And we have photos of them in Henry George Farmer's History of Music in Pictures. It's all in German, but there are some beautiful photos of the clappers and the castanet and everything.
In what language was this book, The Ear's Pleasure and the Science of Listening to Music?
It's all medieval al-Arabi. It's all Arabic. It's very precise, except As-Silani, who edited the manuscript, had to contend with 3 copyists who did the copying. Each did a section. 1 is very beautiful calligraphy, and 2 are absolutely disastrous. A sort of shorthand, very hard to read. So what As-Silani did, he spent 30 years, 30 years, trying to figure out that treatise. And for a lot of poetry, he had to go to other sources, anthologies, to reconstruct the poetry that he could not read easily, or the lines that were missing. So I could not have done this without the edition of Rashid As-Silami, published in Tunisia, 2019, Carthage. And I'm going to send him a copy of my translation and thank him profusely. On top of this, I had to contact him because he's a man of letter and poetry is his forte. Mine is music and musicology. There are a lot of things that were not clear to me. So he helped me with the translation of some of the poems. Also, our repertoire, our legacy, our tradition is very difficult, because these were Renaissance men. They knew so many fields. And when we were brought up in schools and university, we stick to 1 field. But these guys are multidisciplinary. They're wonderful scholars.
Did some of the specialized knowledge that they had, or the medieval Arabic, pose any particular challenges to interpreting or translating into contemporary language today?
Does it ever? I have a paid editor that does the job. Sometimes my wife does it. She's a good editor. And then Braille, they have their own editor. So it goes to at least two stages of editing. And my English, no matter how good it is, I lived in Canada for 53 years, and I speak English all the time. There's still sentences that sound more Arabic than English. And to me, they sound okay, but not for the English speaker. But all of this stuff can be fixed very, very easily. Again, you know, medieval Arabic is a very precise language, way more precise than modern Arabic. They didn't waste time to have long sentences. They're short, they're precise, and very much, very much to the point.
And, I mean, you've spent a great deal of time with the original, the source text. Does Tifashi's book, taken in its entirety, help us draw any conclusions about the universal? I mean, we're here in 2023. That book, his book was written in the 13th century, discussing his recent centuries past. Do you have any reflections on what universal themes we can take from his text across time, across place, across culture, reflected in different musics around the world or the human condition in general?
I would sum it to pleasure. People like pleasure, like to have fun, like to be entertained with good music, good poetry, and good dance. And this is the same today. I mean, I play music for a lot of dancers and singers, and the audience never has enough. They want more. You know, this is the human spirit. We have enough problems with the world, with the climate, wars, destruction. But we need entertainment to take us away from all the tragic things we see in life. This is where music and poetry and dance come in. Long live musicians and poets and dancers. In conclusion, vote for me.
Indeed. Indeed. That's a beautiful way to conclude. unless you had anything else you wanted to add about what you most enjoyed about this project, or what you think is something important that perhaps we've not touched on, you'd like to highlight about the text.
It's the way they write. They use logic. It's a pleasure to read it, not only because it's entertaining, but you learn so much. You learn philosophy. You learn the mode of thinking, the precision of the thoughts, the logic. And sometimes you're enamored not only by the beauty of a particular piece of music, but the way they write about it and the way they're very precise in their language. And I have another book that I published many years ago, and it's called Erotica, Love and Humor in Arabia. The translation from Isfahani Kitab al-Aghani. You can get it on Amazon, on Kindle, for like $7. You will never stop laughing. And I remember when I taught at the University of Toronto, Muslim and Arab students said, "Oh, we have such a boring culture, we have no fun." I said, "No, you're wrong, we have so much fun." And I read them passages from Isfahani, and they fall to the floor laughing. And they love the material. Again, when I read them passages from Al-Farabi, the way he classified the instrument, the way he classified the voices, just amazing feat of beauty. And I said, "Guy, Muslim Arabs, you're not boring. Read your past. We, for 800 years, the Arab and the Muslim world was on top, 800 years, in the art and sciences." So if you have a chance, Ramzi, read the book, my translation of Anecdote from the Aghani. Some are very sort of almost Kama Sutra. It's Kama Sutra of the Arab world. some are very touching poetry, and some poetry make you cry, especially the guy, the Majnun Layla. That's my spiel.
That's a beautiful spiel. I will go running now to look up your previous book, and I really can't wait for this new one to be published by Brill in December. Dr. Sawa, it's really been a pleasure to speak to you and to speak to you about the pleasures of music and everything related to it from the 13th century until now. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure, Ramzi, and thank you very much for making this happen.
And from the ancient past to the contemporary past, from the uses of music at court, we now look at the uses of music in radio productions, and specifically in radio drama. How was music used alongside speech and sound in radio dramas in Western countries? We speak with Dr. Yarmila Mildorf to find out. Dr. Mildorf is co-editor of the book Word, Sound, and Music in Radio Drama. It's published by Brill this November, and her volume is also part of a larger series on word and music studies online. Dr. Mildorf, it's a privilege to have you on the show.
It's nice to meet you on this podcast.
I wanted to begin by talking about the collection as a whole. It's really a fascinating compilation of historical perspectives and also case studies, and it really embodies an interdisciplinary approach. I wanted to ask you, how did the book come together and how did you arrive at this format and focus?
Well, this book is really the brainchild of my co-editor, Pim Verhulst, who unfortunately today can't be with us. He had this idea, since he was working on radio drama, to work specifically on the uses of music in radio drama, because that had been an area that was underexplored. And I myself had launched a subdiscipline of narratology called audio narratology, which focused specifically on the interface between narrative and music. And within this, of course, the combination of music, in combination with sounds and words and so on. So we got together and got thinking about this book project together. And then as it happens, you ask people you already know working in the field. We also sent out a call for papers through various channels, mailing lists, and so on. And we got a really good response, by people working in the field of musicology, literary studies, radio drama specialists, other people interested in radio drama from a cultural studies perspective, etc. So the turnout was great, and we got started on that.
Fantastic. The collection also focuses on the narrative functions of music in radio drama. Could you talk a little bit about what the narrative functions of music in radio drama were? And maybe also later I'll ask you about how this compares with other areas like film or opera or theater in the same period that your collection is looking at.
You're really touching on two subjects here. So the one is the ways in which different media have cross-fertilized one another over the years, over the decades. And the other one is specifically functions of music in radio drama. So when we look at how radio drama was influenced by other media, by other genres, by other literary forms, then of course we see in the beginnings that it was very much influenced by the theater, by opera, by musical theater, but then in turn came to influence other forms like film later on and so on. So we see this cross-fertilization, which in our field we call convergence, the convergence between different media and media representations, and also how there's cross-fertilization here. When we look at the functions of narrative, we can identify a broad range of functions, many of which listeners to this podcast will, of course, be also aware of. I mean, when you go and watch a movie, many of the functions that music has there will be very similar to the ones we see in radio drama as well. So, for example, mood music, that it's meant to create a certain atmosphere to ease the listener into the story world, etc. But then, of course, it can also assume structural functions in the story that's told in a radio play. So, for example, structuring episodes or scenes, that we have transitions between scenes, or we can have little breaks in between scenes. Music can also take on symbolic functions, that it points to certain aspects in the story. It can characterize both characters in the story, but also places or times in which the story is set. So many of these functions are similar to the ones we know from other audio or audiovisual media. But what's very specific about radio drama is, of course, that it's an all auditory genre, which means that apart from the auditory channel, we do not have any other sensory input. Okay, so unlike in film, where you also have the visual channel and you can see on screen what's happening, while you maybe also have some music there, in radio drama, music alongside voices, language, sounds, and also silence, of course, plays a very, very important role, and one that listeners need to pay attention to. And there's obviously also a difference here concerning attention, simply because there is this auditory input, our brains can only process so much at a time, which means that music needs to be used somewhat differently in comparison to how it's used in film, for example, or even in the theater, because it can't interfere with the other sound channels. Okay, so it can't interfere too much with voices and other sounds, otherwise that'd be too taxing for listeners. And this is why we see different uses. Historically, there were different phases in which music were used rather more sparsely in radio drama. Nowadays, I think because of this convergence with film, we see that music is part and parcel of any radio play production, really, and has assumed many of the functions that music has in film as well.
Great. The narrative functions of music, maybe we could ask or look at what counts as music. One of the things that I really liked about this collection is it's a very broad definition of what music is. You include electronic music as much as the musical uses of language itself. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, well, the title of this volume is Word, Sound, and Music in Radio Drama. And this is because music is just one out of a number of what we call semiotic channels, that is, channels that convey meaning to listeners. And the others, obviously, I already mentioned them, include voices, spoken language, noises, but also silences, and maybe other kinds of sounds that are used in very aesthetic ways. So we need to look at the combination of all of these channels and see to what extent the other channels may also be used in a musical sense. That is to say, in a way that it is choreographed to create a sound tapestry to engage listeners. And several of the contributions in this volume look at how certain drama, radio drama writers actually used language, for example, in a musical fashion. That is to say, choreographing the way in which language is used in such a way that it becomes musical. And of course, we can see that this can be done easily because language in itself has musical elements in it, if you want. Okay, there is a rhythm, there's a certain flow to how words are used. You can create musicality by repetitions and other rhetorical features. And this can be exploited or used in very creative ways to have a quasi-musical composition of language. And the same can be done with sounds, okay? The way you arrange sounds can be very artistic in the sense that a certain sequence can be created. So this is obviously a metaphorical usage of the term music or musicality, but that's precisely the beauty of radio drama, that it can afford such a broader conception of music and also, using different sound channels, including voices, including language, including music, in a very aesthetic and appealing way.
A little bit more speculatively, we're here on a podcast in what is definitively the age of the podcast. How do you see music evolving in the podcast era?
Well, I mean, concerning music in general, I think that's a very broad question to ask. Two things that podcasts make possible is, first of all, availability, that music can be made available more easily to a larger group of people, and also the ubiquity, and also the fact that you can have music everywhere, okay? You can listen to music at any time, anywhere you want, because you can download podcasts and have it on your phone or, you know, whatever you use to play that music. So I think it's this availability or accessibility that's one of the important factors. And then, of course, the other factor, the fact that because music is stored, it can be retrieved at any moment, which also means, when we come back to radio drama, that you can access the radio drama over and over again if you want. And if you want to look specifically at how music is used, then you can do that much more precisely, because you can retrace that and just rewind and listen again and so on and so forth. Okay, so the fact that music is recorded here as part of a radio play, and that a radio play as such can be listened to over and over again, that in itself, I think, is the most interesting facet concerning the podcast broadcasting mode. And especially for research, that's fascinating, because when you think of how radio drama was broadcast in the early days, that was always live. And once the radio play had been broadcast, it was out there and you couldn't necessarily listen to it again. That only became possible when recording technologies emerged in the mid 20th century. And now with podcasts, it's so easy for everybody to go back to a radio play that you particularly liked, or for radio scholars to go back to radio plays and just re-listen to them and analyze them more deeply. So in concerning radio drama, I think these are the advantages, that you can listen to things over and over again, but also at any time and at your leisure, whenever and wherever you want. So for music, I think that's great, because for people, they can just access whatever they like at any time. And I think it really helps distributing music through channels, you know, through various channels much more easily.
And as we wrap up now, I think we will be cutting to some transition music on the podcast. thank you so much for speaking with us today, Dr. Mildorf. That's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Ramsey. This was pleasurable.
You've always listened to Humanities Matter, but now you can participate. Tell us what you think about the Humanities Matter podcast. Would you like us to cover any specific topics in this format in the future? Please let us know. Do you have any thoughts about world music you'd like us to take up? Send us a message. You can write us at podcast@brill.com. We'd love to hear from you about any of your thoughts. And if enough of you write to us about a particular topic, including about world music, we will explore those topics in future episodes. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Ramsey Nasser. See you next month.
You are listening to Humanities Matter by Brill.